Hello, you're listening to On Israel in Al Monitor. I'm Ben Kaspit from Tel Aviv. If anyone had entertained any hopes that Israel's new government might revive the long dead negotiations with the Palestinians, Foreign Minister Yair Lapid set them straight a few weeks ago. Lapid promised that when he becomes prime minister in August 2023, he will not conduct talks with the Palestinians, not because he doesn't want to, and not because he doesn't support the two-state solution, but because he is bound to his right-wing coalition partners who opposed such a move. Lapid's entry into office next year will coincide with the 30th anniversary of the Oslo Accords, the only peace agreement Israel has ever reached with the Palestinians. While there have been talks, some movement in implementing the accords, and many crises over the years, both sides appear to have accepted the idea that there is no hope of the peace envisioned in Oslo agreements. They have resigned themselves to making do with counterterrorism coordination, economic cooperation, and more recently with cooperation on limiting the spread of COVID-19. If you had to choose one name synonymous with the Oslo Accords, it would be that of Yossi Beilin, an architect of the historic breakthrough between the sides and the driving force behind many subsequent efforts to salvage the two-state solution. Beilin, who served in various government positions, including as justice minister, began his political career in the Labour Party and ended it as head of the Meretz Party. He retired from politics 13 years ago when he turned 60, just as he promised himself before entering political life. But he has not abandoned his vision of peace between the two nations, nor his efforts to make it come true. Yossi Beilin, Israel's enduring dove, will be with us after this short break.
I'm Elizabeth Hagedorn, and I'm the State Department correspondent at Al Monitor.
And I'm Joe Snell. I'm Al Monitor's video editor. Let's admit it, this past year has been difficult to stay on top of the news and sift through what's accurate and what's misleading. Let Al Monitor help you.
If you care about the Middle East and North Africa, you should consider listening to Al Monitor's audio series On the Middle East with Andrew Parasoliti and Amber Nzimon, and On Israel with Ben Kaspi. You can now watch our newest video podcast, Reading the Middle East with Gilles Kapel. You can subscribe to these series on your favorite podcast platforms.
And through a host of free daily and weekly newsletters, we offer a range of perspectives with the highest journalistic standards. You can subscribe to these newsletters at almonitor.com.
As an award-winning media service headquartered in Washington, D.C., Al Monitor has a network of over 160 contributors around the world.
So if you haven't done so already, be sure to visit almonitor.com, where you can find all of these newsletters and podcasts, along with first-class reporting and analysis.
It's a privilege to welcome to On Israel in Al Monitor a former Minister of Justice, my friend and even colleague Yossi Beilin. Shalom, Yossi. How are you doing? And thank you for joining us here.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's our pleasure. And I just got your new book. I guess it's an autobiography by that you wrote yourself. And in English, how would you call it?
Secrets which I will not take with me.
It's a pity you did not tell me all these secrets when they were relevant. But let's start chatting about the book and about life. How would you describe, Yossi Beilin, the state of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process? Is it dead? Or maybe in an induced coma, or life support machines, or what?
Well, I believe that our tendency to compare political situations to human beings is not always right. I don't know how to define it in such parameters. What I can say is that since 2014, the talks which were actually initiated by Secretary John Kerry then stopped. And since then, we don't have any peace process. I am sure that eventually we will have one. I hope so. But we are speaking about a very long recess, and I don't know when it is going to be renewed, since at least on the Israeli side, there is no partner. And the non-partner is saying very clearly for the first time after many years that he doesn't even intend to meet with the other side.
By the way, even maybe in the case of Naftali Bennett, it's obvious, but even I guess 2 or 3 weeks ago, Yair Lapid, who is supposed to replace Prime Minister Bennett within 1.5 years, said, even when I'm Prime Minister, I will not negotiate with the Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas for a settlement or so. But I want to go with you to square one, maybe. You are the formal architect and initiator of the Oslo Accords and secret negotiation that was before. And do you have any capability to answer the $64 billion question? If PLO leader Yasser Arafat then went along with the Oslo Accords because he wanted peace or because he wanted to weaken the Jewish state and undermine it step by step. Do you, when you're alone with yourself, what do you think?
When I'm alone with myself, I get to the conclusion that trying to understand the motivations of others is something which is very, very, very difficult, if not impossible. And what is important is what are they doing? And I think that Arafat changed his mind. It was in 88, by the way, when he convinced the PLO to change its policy and to agree to the UN Resolution 242. And what happened also was that the decision of King Hussein on the July 31st, 88, to withdraw, to give up on the West Bank. And Arafat understood, I believe, that there is a kind of a vacuum that he could fill. And another thing happened. He supported Saddam Hussein in 1991. And they paid a huge price in the Arab world, in the world generally speaking, and vis-a-vis the Americans as a result of it. It was one of his biggest mistakes. And he wanted very much to get back to the club. And he knew that his most important card would be to negotiate peace with the Israeli side. So whether he wanted to weaken Israel, I'm sure. I mean, he never hid his ideology. But does it mean that he wanted to somehow get rid of Israel and believe that it was possible? I don't think so.
Last question about the past, the Oslo Accords, of course, that no one can speak to you without mentioning it before we go to the present, is about Prime Minister, late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Did he go to Oslo on his own free will, or did you and your former mentor, Shimon Peres, have to draw him into the process gradually?
Well, I'm sure that Rabin went to Oslo with his free will. And I'll tell you what is my view about it. Rabin used a slogan in his electoral campaign saying that during 6 to 9 months, he will have an agreement with the Palestinians. And I'm sure you remember it. This was the main slogan of the elections. Now, he did not succeed to do that. And Rabin wanted very much to fulfill his promises. He did fulfill many of them. And since he could not have a real and serious negotiations with the Palestinians, and what happened then in Washington as a result of the Madrid conference was far from being enough. He understood that he should somehow talk directly with the PLO, and he tried to do it through some envoys, and it did not succeed. So when I came to Paris telling him that we have a paper, an initial paper with PLO senior members, and Peres went with it to Rabin. Rabin, although not being in love with the idea that Peres was the envoy or that I was behind it, still understood that there was an opportunity then. Without such a paper, he wouldn't have agreed to join the process and to lead it. But once he saw that there was such a paper speaking about Gaza first and then other developments in the West Bank, he understood the seriousness, which he, by the way, tested later on a few times during the process, and eventually was not only ready to join it, but also was, in his own shy way, enthusiastic about it.
Another question I cannot hold myself not to ask, I just thought about it now. Since November 95, how many times did you ask yourself what would have happened if Rabin was not assassinated? And do you have any answer for it? Or did you, maybe you didn't ask it at all because he was assassinated, this is reality, and we have to go on.
I asked myself this question many times, and I knew that it was stupid to ask it.
You are right. Let's talk a little about the book. Can you share with us some of the revelations in your new autobiography, Secrets, that I will not take with me behind the scenes of all the so many negotiations and processes and everything you've been involved with within the last two or three decades?
You know, during these years, there were many, many surprises. And you complained before that I did not share it with you at a time. But had I shared it with you, I think that it would have been really a kind of an atomic bomb. And I'll give you an example. The example is from 1995, the beginning of 1995. There were talks between a group of Israelis and a group of Palestinians led by Rabin and Arafat in the Erez passage between Gaza and Israel. And it was in the midst of the negotiations on the autonomy agreement, which was signed later on in September 95. And there were some issues that Arafat wanted to raise with Rabin. I was there with Rabin, and Saeb Erekat, the late Saeb Erekat, came with Arafat. Arafat raised several points that he wanted Rabin to agree on. And one of them was the issue of direct election of the president, the Palestinian president. According to the drafts, the Palestinian president should have been elected by the Palestinian legislative body. And he wanted that the Palestinian president would be elected by the people. And he said, you know, Mr. Rabin, you are going to have elections in a year or 2 years, and you are going to elect for the first time your prime minister directly. So why do you deprive me from being elected directly like you? And then there was an intermission, and the two parties went to different rooms to discuss the discussions, and then to get back after half an hour or something like that. So I sat with Rabin, and he raised some questions. And then there was a knock on the door, and an Israeli soldier who was there asked me to told me that Saeb Erekat, the Palestinian chief negotiator, asked me to talk with him about an urgent issue. I said that, but I cannot. I'm sitting with the prime minister. And he said, no, it is urgent. And Rabin said, go to talk with him. Maybe he has some surprise for us. And it was a surprise. It was a crazy surprise. Yes, Saeb Erekat wanted to talk to me about the direct election of the Palestinian president. And he said to me, Yossi, you know that I'm loyal to Arafat, but I'm also loyal very much to the Palestinian people. If you agree for a direct election of the president, you are actually assisting a tendency to have on our side a Palestinian dictatorship like all the other Arab states. If the president is elected in the parliament, at least we will have influence on him, because he will be dependent on us. If not, he will not dependent on anybody. Please ask the prime minister not to agree to Arafat's demand. You know, I heard this and I couldn't believe myself. I mean, there was nobody was closer to Arafat than Saeb Erekat. And here he comes to me and asked me not to agree to what his boss wants the most. And he said to me, Yossi, you have to understand, all the other requests are important for Arafat, but nothing is close to this demand to be directly elected.
It is really unbelievable.
I went to Rabin and I told him, Itzhak, you will not believe me, but this is the request of Saeb Erekat. And Rabin thought for a while and said to me, Yossi, I understand, and he is right, of course. But, you know, Arafat came to me with so many requests and I cannot meet any of them but this one. And I will say yes to him, understanding the difficulty of saying yes. And this was the case. Yes. We came to the room, to the joint meeting. Rabin referred to the difficulties, to his difficulties, to meet the challenges that Arafat put in front of him. And then he said, but Mr. Chairman, one thing I can accept, I understand your case, your point, and we will agree to direct election of the president. And I looked at Arafat and I saw kind of satisfaction, happiness. I don't know how to exactly define it. And then I saw Saeb Erekat.
So disappointed.
Gray face when listening to the decision of Rabin. I think that this was perhaps one of the most one of the biggest surprises ever in the negotiations. And I admit that had Saeb Erekat, my friend, been alive, I wouldn't have published
it. Yes. By the way, they are all dead. I think Mahmoud Abbas and yourself are the last two Mohicans from all this process, and I wanted to ask you about him. And it's a fascinating story. By the way, it shows also the amount of trust that Saeb Erekat gave you, because you can you could leak it out, and then he's dead. But two quick questions. You've been advocating an Israeli-Palestinian confederation in recent years. I wanted to know if that does it mean that you've given up on the two-state, the original two-state solution or idea? And also about Mahmoud Abbas, that has lost much of the Palestinian people's support. in this elderly Sikh leader, is he still a partner for peace, or are you the only Mohican left in this arena?
Well, speaking about the two-state solution, you know, my interest as a Zionist is to have a border between us and the Palestinians in order to assure a Jewish majority forever. Now, this is why I supported a Palestinian-Jordanian state, a Palestinian-Jordanian confederation, and even unilateral withdrawal if Israel decides, I believe wrongly, that there is no partner. So I'm not giving on the border, and I think that the best way to have a border is in an agreement with the Palestinian state. But I see the Confederation as the most important vehicle to have such a two-state solution. It is an enabler, not a substitute, not an alternative. Because if there is a Confederation, there will be a possibility not to evacuate those settlements which will remain to the east of the future border between us and the Palestinians. And I believe that the issue of evacuation of settlers is the biggest hurdle for any Israeli leader who will be ready to go for peace and to pay the territorial price, because the territorial price is not the most important or the most difficult issue. What is difficult is to face many Israelis who will have to leave their homes, and we saw what happened in the past. It is not impossible, but it is very difficult. And I think that politically, it is a must for those who support the two-state solution. Now, a confederation is much wider than that. And we are working today in the last 2 years, and we have been working on it, and the Israelis and Palestinians in an informal way. And I hope that in the coming weeks, we will be able to expose it. But part of the book that we are preparing on Confederation, you will see a joint narrative. And never before the two parties agreed, or even perhaps tried to agree on a joint narrative. You know, people used to criticize me that what I tried to do was mainly an effort to solve the problem of 67, but not of the problem of 48, namely the issue of the refugees and other derivative problems which were born then. And here, this is a very interesting, I believe, effort to base the confederation on a joint narrative.
Interesting. So now you just told us that you're working on a book about confederation, and I'm looking forward.
Yes. It is not a pardon?
You're writing it alone or with Eli?
No. I mean, writing alone is the easiest thing in the world, having one-sided agreements. Whatever I did was always with the Palestinians and with significant Palestinians, because if it is not with them, then it is another idea. Maybe yeah. It is good, it is bad. But here, when you show your partner, you are in a very different situation. So maybe. We do have partners, and this will be exposed very soon.
Yeah, the new version or generation of the Geneva Accords that you also is one of your projects in the past. Now, let's touch a little the Israeli politics, which is very fascinating in these days. And if you had stayed in Israeli politics, you've been the chairman of Meretz, would you have brought Meretz into a government led by such an ideological opposite as Naftali Bennett? Would you serve as a minister in Naftali Bennett's government?
Yeah, he is a very strange bedfellow, I must admit. And had you asked me such a question a year ago, or I don't know, 7 months ago, my answer would have been negative, I presume. But you get to a situation and you have to take decisions. And had I been the leader of Meretz today, I would have done what the leader of Meretz did and joined the government. I think that what is happening today is not a model for the future. I wouldn't like to see such governments for a long time. But it is a kind of a interim solution in which we can prevent very, very problematic decisions on the one hand, on more settlements and whatever, and on the other hand, to replace a very, very bad prime minister. And we did it.
Do you think he was a threat, a real threat to democracy? I'm talking about the previous prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu.
I think that what happened to him was a process. It wasn't that from day one he was a threat to democracy, not at all. He's an intelligent person, and I believe that generally speaking, he was a much more liberal and open-minded, but the long years in power did not make him a better prime minister. It is the other way around. And the accusations against him and eventually the indictment put him in a very, very different a transformation that he took very problematic decisions like encouraging people like Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is really beyond any kind of Israeli mainstream a minimal mainstream and made him such an important person in Israeli politics in an artificial way.
Okay, let's go back to something that you're writing in your book. You say that your actions are all guided by the idea of Jewish continuity. Could you explain?
I was born 3 years after the Holocaust. And the Holocaust became for my generation and for your generation, I think, the most important variable. I mean, we don't have to speak about it every day, but I think that every day we are doing things which are this way or another connected to what happened between 39 and 45. And as a kid, I mean, this was the most important thing in my life, although I'm not coming from, I mean, my parents were not Holocaust survivors. They came with their families in the 20s and did not have to go, thanks heaven, through this awful years in Europe. And whatever I did, I mean, for me, Oslo and the birthright are on the same spectrum. I mean, for me, the continuation of the Jewish people is the most important thing for me. And don't ask me why. I mean, I'm not sure that I have a logical, rational reason. I see the Jewish people as my family, my extended family. And I want this family to prosper, to succeed, and to be there. And I'm trying to do different things in order to assure that this will be the case, because I take nothing for granted. I mean, if you one thinks about the Holocaust, he or she must understand that something like that can happen. And if it can happen, and I'm sure that until 39, people would say something like that will never happen. It happened already. And then you ask yourself, how can you save these people? Now, there are those who say, hey, this is not your job. And the Jewish continuity is not such an important aim. The world will not lose much if Jews are not around, convert to other religions or just give up on their Judaism. And I cannot prove anything. I'm just saying that this is very important for me, and you must accept it from me.
And I know it's authentic, Yossi. I know it's authentic, very authentic in your side. And I want to ask you, because one of the most major ideas and projects you've been initiated in this field is you are one of the founders of the Taglit Birthright Program that has brought hundreds of thousands of young Jews from all over the world to visit Israel. Has the program fulfilled its goal? Does it still maintain ties between Israel and the Jewish diaspora, despite the growing ideological gap between American liberal Jewry and Israel that is going to the opposite direction?
You know, I invented this idea in 94, and some of the founding fathers of Taglit were the biggest opponents of this idea before they changed their minds. And the idea was to have a meeting point, a Jewish meeting point, in a place which I believe is the most symbolic one for the Jewish people, and this is the land of Israel. And the success is really much bigger than what I expected. It is the biggest project in the Jewish world, the most financed. It is the financial support for that is bigger than for the Jewish Agency and other institutions and projects. And as you said, hundreds of thousands, about 700,000 young students from all over the world, but it is mainly from America, came to Israel, and some thousands remained in Israel, and others married each other. And I think that the most important thing is that they touched Israel, and beforehand, a very small percentage of Jews in the young Jews in the world visited Israel. So this is a revolution in Jewish world. And even those who criticize us and don't accept the policy of the Israeli governments are having a very important connection with Israel. They continue their relationships through the emails and WhatsApps and the social networks. And they are more active than others in Jewish life, in the Jewish federations and so on. And this was my aim. My aim was not to make out of them our ambassadors. For that we have a foreign ministry, and they should not just echo the Israeli official policy. What they have to do, I mean, even if they are very much against it or for it or whatever, the mere fact that they have been here and saw us and talked with us, and is the most important thing for me. I always said that the bus of Birthright is much more important for me than Masada.
I agree. I 100% agree. But Yossi, I wanted to hear your opinion about the widening gap between, let's talk about the American, the North American Jewry, which most of it is liberal, left-leaning in politics, left-leaning in politics, and Israel, who is going all the way to the more conservative and the more right-wing than you saw it in the Netanyahu years, with the Kotel and with the many, many other aspects, and the new generation of young American Jews don't feel close to Israel as they felt. They don't remember that they haven't been in the Holocaust. Their grandfathers and grandmothers are not alive anymore, and it becomes a problem. Is the glit enough to overcome this obstacle?
No way. The glit is not enough, and was not born in order to do that. I mean, it can contribute to bridging the gap, but it cannot really fill the gap. We have to do other things. One of the things that we have to do is to find ways how to contain the new kind of Jews which are born today in the United States. I mean, what we are doing is that we stick to Orthodox definitions of who is a Jew, rather than to admit, whether we like it or not, that there are other kinds of Jews today. Like, for example, the children of the Clinton family. If you remember the very famous wedding party in which there was a rabbi and the priest. And because Chelsea Clinton was married, yes, to married a Jew. And you know, for me, as a child from Tel Aviv, it was very strange. I didn't like the idea of a rabbi and a priest. And then I asked myself, who are you? Who are you to decide for that? I mean, if the kids will be born, they were born already, decide that they see themselves as Jews, would you be able to say, no, you are not, because your father is a Jew and your mother is not? I want to contain as many as possible Jews and not to reject them. And there are many others in Israel who say, if they are not Jews comme il faut, we don't need them. And this is a very, very big argument. And I as a chairman of Hillel in Israel, and in other capacities, I'm dealing with this issue. I'm talking to people, I'm talking to my American Jewish friends in order to try and see how can we institutionally find solutions for this problem. Because if we can find a solution for this problem, I think that we can do a lot. And also, if I may say, I believe that if Israel makes peace with all its neighbors, the attitude of the American Jewry will be different.
We'll wait and see, as we say. And finally, let me ask you an easy one. Since I know you, I knew you, I was sure that you're the most optimistic person I ever met. Now, many years passed, are you hopeful or pessimistic about Israel's future?
I'm hopeful, but not in a sense that I'm saying to you, you know what, it will be better, it will be okay, eventually things will be fine. I don't believe in an automatic, optimistic situation. What I believe is that if we are taking the right steps, eventually we will assure the future of our country. And otherwise, God forbid, it may become just a very interesting and failed experiment.
Yossi Beilin, it was a real treat. Very interesting. I thank you very much again for joining us here on Israel.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take a short break and come back with some final thoughts right after it. Toda, Yossi.
Toda.
Hello, I'm Gilles Kepel, professor at Sciences Po and the Normal Sup in Paris, and author of a number of books and articles on the Middle East. Through my new podcast, Reading the Middle East, on the award-winning media service and Monitor, we will take a deep dive into the trends in the region with the authors and thought leaders who are shaping how we think about the Middle East. Reading the Middle East will be a fantastic addition to Al Monitor's outstanding podcast lineup, including On the Middle East with Andrew Parazeliti and Amber Inzaman, and On Israel with Ben Caspit. You can subscribe on your favorite listening platforms. We look forward to your joining our conversation.
Thank you for staying with us. The conversation with Mr. Peace, the Israeli Yossi Beilin, was, in my opinion, fascinating. First of all, I asked him a question that I asked myself in the last 30 years. How did they succeed? Shimon Peres, his mentor himself, to drag into the Oslo Agreement, the Oslo Accords, the Oslo process, which was highly secret in the first months. No one knew about it. The hawkish Yitzhak Rabin, and Beilin said that Rabin came to the process in his own free will. You know, he did not like the fact that Peres and Bailyn were the leaders, but he did not hesitate. He wanted to solve the Palestinian problem. He knew the importance of getting anything in this track, and no one forced him to do so. One unbelievable story he told us was about that moment in the negotiation when the sides went each to his chambers, and he sat with Rabin and Peres, and Arafat sat with his people, and suddenly Saeb Arikat, the chief Palestinian negotiator and a very close friend of Bailyn, asked Bailyn to meet him in Four Eyes, and Bailyn got Rabin's permission, and then Arikat asked Bailyn to ask Rabin to refuse to Arafat's request that Rabin will agree to direct electing the Palestinian president. Arikat told him, if you'll do so, we'll have here dictatorship like in all the Arab world. The only way to have the Palestinians have a democracy is going for a parliament election, and then when the president will be elected by parliament, we'll have democracy. Bailyn tried to do so, but Rabin, unbelievably, agreed to Arafat's request because he refused to all the other requests, and he decided to say yes to this one. Another key question focused on the Confederation, the Israeli-Palestinian Confederation idea, which is something that Bailyn is talking and pushing in the last few years, because the two-state solution is, let's say, limping. And he said he did not abandon the two-state solution, or actually the idea that we need border between Israel and the Palestinian state, in his words, to ensure a Jewish state forever. So he said, I'm not giving up the border idea. The best way, of course, is to have a border between the two states. But when he's talking about the Confederation, this idea, Bailyn said, does not contradict the border and the two-state solution. It is actually an enabler to the very same theory or agenda. And he said, when you're going for a Confederation, the main thing that people are saying about Bailyn, that he's going to a Palestinian state and he's actually solving the problem of the 67, not the problem of 48. With the Confederation, Bailyn says, it solves all the problems and it creates a total different creature that most of its interests will be common. Maybe it's utopia, but this is how Bailyn thinks. Finally, I asked him if he would still now, in these days, be the Meretz chairman. Would he take Meretz with him into the Bennett-Lapid government and sit as a minister like Nitzan Horowitz is doing right now, Minister of Health in the Bennett government, and said, if it was he was asked this question 7 months or 1 year ago, he would have refused, of course. But right now, he would do exactly what Nitzan Horowitz did, join the government. It's not a model for the future. I would not like, said Bailyn, this kind of government for the long term. It's actually an interim agreement because with this government, we stopped, said Bailyn, very terrible things that could happen to Israel. And we replaced a very bad prime minister. And when I asked him if he agrees to the whatever are saying Gideon Saar and Avigdor Lieberman, that Netanyahu was a threat on Israeli democracy, Bailyn surprised me. He said yes, but not from the beginning. In the beginning, he was so talented and young and a lot of hopes. But this long stay in office, 12 consecutive years and 15 years all around combined, made him in a position that he could not help himself, and he became a threat. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope to find you here next time, next week, the same place on Israel in Al Monitor. I am Ben Kaspit from Tel Aviv. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hear that? That's the sound of change being cooked up in our schools. Each day, school food professionals throughout California are working to make better meals for our kids, one tray at a time. These meal planning, sauce stirring, taste bud training professionals are making food for students from kindergarten to high school using fresher ingredients and flavors kids love. The secret ingredient to better school food in California? The dedicated professionals who are improving it every day. Learn more about how they're cooking up change at schoolfoodpros.org. Grant provided by California Community College's Chancellor's Office.